Once again, in this session after lunch, we're going to continue our discussion of the preliminaries, the foundation practices. So first we'll do a meditation related to one of the foundational preliminary practices, and then we'll go back into the text and look at some of the more in detail these practices. Finding that nice, comfortable posture. Keeping the back nice and straight. Keeping the body as still as possible. And allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. Relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. Simply allow the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Now imagine that you've just gone to your doctor for your annual physical checkup. Some tests are done. You feel fine and don't expect any problems. Some days pass, and the doctor calls you to come in to discuss your results. The news is not good. The doctor tells you you have an incurable disease. And that you have approximately 12 months to live. You leave the doctor's office and sit down in the waiting room to gather your thoughts. How do you feel? What do you want to do? You go home. Knowing that you have approximately 12 months to live, what are you now going to do with your time? What are your priorities? So reflect for a while now on what you want to do for the next 12 months. What is important to you? issues that you need to resolve with anybody. Is there anything you would like to do for yourself? Is there anything you would like to do for anyone else? And to conclude this meditation, let's spend a few moments to appreciate the preciousness of our life and how it will quickly come to an end. Make some definite conclusions about how you would like to spend your time during this precious time that you have. How would you like to make your life most meaningful? So let's go back into the text here, back into page one in the middle. So we're looking at the preliminaries. So the preliminaries, again, are the foundation practices to help establish us a good basis for engaging in the Mahamudra practice, the practices of Shamatha and Vipassana. So what we've seen already is in the first sentence, it says, in order to have a doorway for entering into the Dharma and a central pillar for the Mahayana, sincerely go for refuge and generate bodhicitta without these being merely words from your mouth. So yesterday we saw that the doorway of entering into the Dharma is to go for refuge. Refuge in the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So when we can develop faith and conviction that Buddha, Dharma, the teachings and the spiritual community are what we can rely on in our life, that we'll turn to these three jewels for refuge, then we have entered into the Dharma, into the Buddhist teachings. And then, of course, the Mahayana vehicle is the vehicle to strive for an enlightenment. So to enter into the Mahayana path, the door of entry is when we develop the aspiration for enlightenment, i.e. bodhicitta. So bodhicitta is the aspiration for enlightenment for the benefit of others. So once we've cultivated this aspiration of bodhicitta, we have entered into the Mahayana. But it's not only the door of entry into the Mahayana, it's the central pillar, the central support, meaning all of our practices in the Mahayana path are supported by the motivation of bodhicitta. So here it's saying that this is one of the fundamental preliminaries or foundations for the Mahayana, the Mahamudra practice. And the Panchen Lama here says to go for refuge and generate bodhicitta without these being merely words from your mouth. So here when we talk about cultivating this refuge in bodhicitta, then they in themselves are full practices to do this, to really cultivate these refuge and bodhicitta, as we're going to see later. But also, of course, as we're going to see in the next session, that we also cultivate these at the beginning of each meditation session, that we have a door of entry and support for our actual meditation. So at the beginning of a meditation session, then we often have a four-line verse going for refuge and generating bodhicitta. So we have a door of entry and support for our practice, our meditation practice. And we can see this actually if you go to the last page of your booklet. On the front of the last page, there's this prayers for meditation. And the second verse there, we see going for refuge and generating bodhicitta. And so this is something very common in the Tibetan tradition, that you recite this verse, and here it says three times, at the beginning of any practice. So very common that we do this. We go, I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, by my practice of giving in other perfections, so here the six perfections, may I become a Buddha for the benefit of all sentient beings. So that's bodhicitta. And so we have that very often at the beginning of any meditation session. We recite this verbally or even mentally three times. But, of course, the danger is that we do it merely words from our mouth. We just go, I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to Buddha. And generally we do it very quick because we want to get it out of the way, because we want to spend more time meditating than doing these things. So we recite this verse very quickly, three times, and then we go, okay, what now? And so then, of course, it doesn't have any impact, effect. So the Panchen Lama is telling us that we need to make sure that when we do these practices, we don't have them as merely words from our mouth, that actually they have some impact, some effect. And for that to happen, then what we find is in the Mahamudra tradition, they have what's called the four common preliminaries. And here, and often in the Kagyu tradition, they are called the four thoughts. The four thoughts that turn the mind. So when it means the four common preliminaries, it means it's those are preliminaries common to all levels of practice, not just Mahamudra. And you actually see this in those prayers for meditation. So particularly in the Mahamudra tradition, particularly in the Kagyu school, when you have this sort of prayers for meditation, then you actually do have first these four thoughts coming before refuge and bodhicitta. The idea being is that if we reflect on each of these four points, this will... the four thoughts that turn the mind, this will turn our mind towards the Dharma, towards bodhicitta. So if we reflect on these four points before in the beginning of a meditation, but also we work on each of these four points as a separate practice as well, then when we reflect on these four points briefly at the beginning of a meditation session, then we go for refuge and generate bodhicitta, they're more likely to have some impact rather than just merely words from our mouth. So let's have a look at these four thoughts here and what they are. So the first one, it says, this precious life of leisure and opportunity is rare and easily lost. So this is to reflect on precious human life. So, of course, those of you who have studied a little bit the Lam Rim stages of the path in the Gluck school will know that this is one of the very first reflections in the Lam Rim, and in many of the other systems as well, this is one of the very first reflections. Because if we don't reflect on our precious human life, then often we just simply waste our life. We take it for granted. And generally in our life, unfortunately, we tend to only appreciate something once we've lost it or about to lose it. So often we don't appreciate our precious life until we're about to lose it. And we go, oh. And then we have full of regret about having wasted our life. So by reflecting on our precious human life, then we can see how precious it is, how much opportunity we have in our life to make our life meaningful. And then we're going to want to make our life meaningful and not to waste our life. Because not only do we have a human life, but we have, as the first line says, a life of leisure and opportunity. Leisure here means freedom from adverse conditions. And opportunity means positive conditions. So, of course, we're all living in a time and place where we have easy access to many different spiritual traditions. For the very first time in human history, we have so many spiritual traditions at our fingertips. And also, of course, most of us here, of course, financially okay, roof over our head, living in a country that is not dominated by war and oppression and so forth. So we have a lot of freedom and time to devote ourselves to meaningful things in life. So if we reflect on these sorts of things, then we will not waste our life. So here it says that this precious life, and that our life is precious because we have all these opportunities, and it says it's rare and easily lost. And, I mean, if we just look at the world today, and how many people really, if we take the whole world, how many people have the opportunities that we have now? Not that many. And it says easily lost is that we have this precious opportunity. We tend to take it for granted, but actually we can easily lose this, you know, through health reasons, through environmental reasons. I mean, many things can happen where we suddenly don't have this opportunity anymore. So if we can reflect on this, then we'll see how wonderful an opportunity we have, and we're going to want to take advantage of it. So this is the first reflection. And from this, we can avoid a common situation that people find themselves in, and that is later in their life, of course, as they're approaching death, now they're about to lose this precious opportunity. Now they realize how precious it was, and then they're full of regrets at having wasted their life. So we can avoid this situation of regretting wasting our life by doing this reflection, and then we'll really want to make our life as meaningful as possible. Now, this is very helpful for this, but even if we do this reflection and we can maybe appreciate the preciousness of our life and we want to make it meaningful, there still can be this tendency, yes, it's precious, I want to make it meaningful, but I'm busy now. You know, I'm going to do that spiritual stuff later. Now I'm busy with my career and all sorts of other things. I'll do that spiritual stuff later. And of course, then we keep putting it off and off and off, and we never begin. So to help us avoid this, we have the second, which says here, the world and those within it are impermanent. I too will die soon. So this is to reflect on death and impermanence. And this is a little bit what we did in that meditation, of course. Here when we talk about impermanence, we can talk about impermanence at two levels. coarse and subtle. So what we've been talking about already a little bit earlier, impermanence, is subtle impermanence, which is the fact that everything's changing moment by moment. But we can also talk about coarse impermanence. And coarse impermanence means something is created, it's there for a while, and then it's finished. So the coarse impermanence that we're reflecting on here, the one that is meaningful, is to reflect on our death, the fact that our life will come to an end. And so if we reflect on the fact that we're going to die, then we'll understand that this precious opportunity is not going to last forever. In fact, we don't know when we're going to die, and so therefore we'll want to make our life meaningful right now. We won't postpone, we won't put it off, and we won't want to waste any of our precious life on any meaningless tasks. In fact, that reminds me, like, some years ago in a course I was doing in India, I had one of the people in my class was a lady from Ireland, and she was working in the hospice movement, looking after terminally ill people. And she told me that it wasn't uncommon for her patients or to the people she was caring for to tell her that getting this terminal illness that they had was actually the best thing that happened to them in their life. She said it wasn't uncommon. I mean, if they got past, often they go through the denial phase, but if they get through the phase of accepting that, she said it wasn't uncommon for them to tell her that it was the best thing that happened to them there in life. Because now they see how precious their life is, and they want to make most use of whatever time they have left. And they don't want to waste their life in the slightest. Of course, we don't have to have a terminal illness to have this wish. We can just do this reflection a little bit like we did in the meditation. And if we do this reflection, then we will also develop this wish to make our life meaningful and not waste our life. Also recently I saw on the internet a lady who had got some terminal illness, I can't remember what it was, and she had something like 6 months to live or something, and she was pleading on the internet for people not to waste their life. She was saying, please don't waste your life on meaningless things. You don't have that much time. So she was pleading for people to do that. And also here I have a couple of quotes regarding this, because, you know, often people feel like reflecting on death is very morbid and, you know, they just feel bad if they reflect on death. But actually, it's not true. And reflecting on death can really inspire us to make our life meaningful. So I've got two quotes here that I'd like to read out. The first one is from Steve Jobs. I think everyone knows who Steve Jobs, the ex-CEO of Apple. He passed away from cancer, of course. 10 years ago, he gave a talk to the students at Stanford University. And part of his talk is the following. I'm just reading a short part, two paragraphs. He says, "When I was 17, I read a quote that went something like, 'If you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right.' It made an impression on me. And since then, for the past 33 years, I have looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I'm about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride or fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart." And then And then just recently, last month or two ago, I saw an article on the internet from the New York Times, and it was all about, you know, New Year's resolutions. And the title was, "To Be Happier, Start Thinking More About Your Death." And the author says the following: "Want a better 2016? Try thinking more about your impending demise. Years ago, on a visit to Thailand, I was surprised to learn that Buddhist monks often contemplate the photos of corpses in various stages of decay. The Buddha himself recommended corpse meditation. This body too, students were taught to say about their own bodies, such is its nature, such is its future, such is its unavoidable fate. Paradoxically, this meditation on death is intended as a key to better living. It makes disciples aware of the transitory nature of their own physical lives and stimulates a realignment between momentary desires and existential goals. In other words, it makes one ask, am I making the right use of my scarce and precious life?" And then a little bit later he says, "The secret is not simply a resolution to stop wasting time, however. It is to find a systematic way to raise the scarcity of time to our consciousness. Even if contemplating a corpse is a bit too much, you can still practice some of the Buddha's wisdom, resolving to live as if 2016 were your last year. Then remorselessly root out activities, small and large, that don't pass the last year test." So a little bit what we've been saying. Often when that comes up, then often people have a few objections. They say, you know, well, if I've only got a certain amount of time to live, I'm just going to spend all my money and so forth. And he has something to say about this. He says, "Some might think that the last year test is impractical. As an acquaintance of mine joked, if I had 1 year to live, I'd run up my credit cards. In truth, he probably wouldn't. In a new paper in a scientific journal, two psychologists looked at the present value of money when people contemplated death. One might assume that when reminded of death, people would greatly value current spending over future spending. But that's not how it turned out. Considering death actually made respondents less likely to want to blow money now than other scenarios did." But then also, the other thing is that often people feel, if I contemplate death, I'm going to be very morbid and feel very bad and so forth. He has something to say about this too. He says, "Will cultivating awareness of the scarcity of your time make you grim and serious? Not at all. In fact, there is some evidence that contemplating death makes you funnier. Two scholars in 2013 published an academic paper detailing research in which they subliminally primed people to think about either death or pain and then asked them to caption cartoons. So you know, you've got a cartoon and you have to write something funny about the cartoon. And it said, outside raters found that death-primed participants captions to be funnier. So it seems like people who thought about death actually made funnier captions than the average person. So anyway, I thought that was quite interesting. I just read it recently. So these are the two first reflections, precious human life and death, and they go very well together. And through reflecting on both of these, then we'll really want to make our life meaningful right now. And then, of course, what to do, how to make our life meaningful, then the third point can help us a little bit there, and that is, the results of my virtuous and non-virtuous actions will without fail ripen within me. So, of course, this is the reflection on karma. understanding that harmful behavior leads to suffering, virtuous behavior leads to happiness. So by reflecting on this, then we would adopt an ethical lifestyle as a basis for any sort of meaningful life. And what I'd like to do in tomorrow's session, the corresponding session tomorrow, is have a look at this ethical lifestyle in some more detail. How we could build a basis of an ethical lifestyle. So that's going to come tomorrow. So that's the third reflection. So the first two would help us to make a meaningful life, inspire us. The reflection on karma would help us to adopt an ethical lifestyle as a basis for that. And then the fourth reflection here, it says, and since there is no genuine happiness to be found within the abodes of samsara, I must correctly practice this true dharma, the true dharma. So here is to reflect on the unsatisfactory nature of samsara. And this is really to reflect on the first of the Four Noble Truths. What this really means is to reflect on the very type of existence we have now. And the very type of existence we have now, the Buddha used the word dukkha to describe that. That we are stuck in this state of dukkha. Now, this is often translated as suffering. Because this word dukkha in Sanskrit, very difficult to translate in English. There's not really any word in English that has the same meaning. So the most common way, or the most common translation for this is suffering. So remember, this is a word describing our very existence, the type of existence we have, the state we find ourselves in. So then you'll hear, based on this translation, you'll hear things like people saying, according to Buddhism, all life is suffering. And then we hear that and we go, oh, that doesn't sound right. You know, sometimes I'm okay, I have some pleasure, not too bad sometimes. So that doesn't sound right. I mean, what they're saying is that according to Buddha, our life is dukkha. What does that really mean? To try and understand what that means, we can talk about three types or three levels of dukkha. The first type or level of dukkha is the dukkha of suffering. And here the word suffering does mean unpleasant, painful, physical, mental experiences. So part of the human condition is that sometimes, in fact, we do have suffering. Sometimes we do have unpleasant, painful, physical, mental experiences. I think we can all relate to that. And then there's the dukkha of change, which is talking about our pleasant experiences. So part of the human condition is that sometimes we also have pleasant physical and mental experiences. And to describe those experiences, the Buddha used the word change to really highlight that our pleasant experiences change, meaning they're transient, they're temporary, they're stimulus-based. Stimulus finishes, experience finishes. And also that these are, of course, unreliable. We can't just click our fingers and have a pleasant experience whenever we want one. They require a certain stimulus. If there's no stimulus, there's no pleasant experience. But also, these pleasant experiences are not even in the nature of happiness. Because generally, we do equate pleasure with happiness. So we do now actually see our pleasant experiences as happiness. But if these pleasant experiences were in the nature of happiness, it would mean that the more we indulged in them, the more happy we should become. But we know from our own experience, often when we overindulge in pleasant experiences, they turn into suffering. From that, we can understand that pleasant experiences are not in the nature of happiness. They're in fact just relative experiences. Relative to a previous state, they're an improvement. But if we overindulge in those very experiences, often they turn into suffering themselves. So this is what we are to understand here, that part of the human condition is we have pleasant experiences, but it's not genuine happiness, and they're just temporary, transient experiences. But underlying both our pleasant and unpleasant experiences, there's something deeper going on in our life. And that is what's called all-pervasive dukkha. All-pervasive dukkha means that our human condition is such that there is nowhere we can go or be and be free of the potential of suffering. That there's always a potential of suffering in our life. That is all-pervasive. All it needs is certain conditions to come together and there can be suffering arise. So even though at the moment we're not suffering, in this very present moment, that potential is always there. That's what all-pervasive means. Why is that potential there in every single moment? Is because our mind is contaminated. As long as our mind is contaminated by mental afflictions, that potential is there all the time. That's what all-pervasive means. So this is what the word dukkha covers. The word dukkha covers all of this. So to avoid the confusion of translating it as suffering, some translators translate this as unsatisfactory, as we see here, the unsatisfactory nature of samsara. So why is our life unsatisfactory? It's unsatisfactory because we have unpleasant, painful experiences. That's quite unsatisfactory. Our life is unsatisfactory because our pleasant experiences never last and they're unreliable. And at the deepest level, our life is unsatisfactory because there's always a potential for suffering. That's what we are to reflect on here. And if we reflect on that here, we can understand that there is no genuine happiness to be found out there, as we see in the verse. And since there is no genuine happiness to be found within the abodes of samsara, that is the conclusion of this reflection, then we're going to stop looking out there for genuine happiness and we're going to turn our attention inwards. And so from this reflection, we can develop the aspiration for liberation, renunciation. So these are the four thoughts. So if we really reflect on those as individual practices, and then at the start of a meditation session, we briefly reflect on each of those four points based on our previous contemplation in detail on those, then those states of mind that are generated by reflecting on that will be a very good basis for then going for refuge and generating bodhicitta so that they're not merely words from our mouth. So that's why you often see in the Mahamudra meditation texts, like here, you actually have these four lines at the very beginning before the refuge and bodhicitta for that purpose. Any questions about any of these four thoughts?
Yeah. Of dukkha.
Yeah, I mean, normally dukkha is translated as suffering. So people say this is suffering of suffering.
So, but in Sanskrit, is it dukkha of dukkha or not, so the first one?
Oh, the Sanskrit word here? No, I don't think so.
No dukkha.
I'm not sure. I don't know the Sanskrit words that have been used here.
Okay. I couldn't answer that. I mean, it wouldn't make sense, dukkha of dukkha.
I guess in Sanskrit these are different words.
I'm assuming, but I don't know. I don't know the Sanskrit words there. Anything else from any of these four thoughts that anyone would like to ask? So by reflecting on these four thoughts, and so each of those, of course, are complete meditations themselves that we can engage in and really work on. And then at the beginning of a meditation session, we can briefly reflect on each of those four points as a basis for then really sincerely going for refuge, generating bodhicitta. And then, of course, as a basis for the bodhicitta practice, we're looking at that in the evening sessions. So yesterday evening we started to look at the four immeasurables, loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity, to cultivate these qualities as a basis for bodhicitta. And then on that basis, what we're going to look at also, I think maybe tomorrow evening, I think it is, we're going to look at actual practices, techniques based on the four immeasurables that can help us to actually develop bodhicitta. And historically, there were two main methods that were used on the basis of the four immeasurables then to go on to cultivate this bodhicitta. And we're going to look at those two methods tomorrow evening. And then we're going to one of the methods, which I think is more applicable or powerful for us in our modern society, we're going to then use that method as some meditations then in the days coming in the evening session to really try and develop that. So that's as much as I wanted to talk about. But maybe we've still got a couple of minutes, so maybe we'll look a little bit more in the text here and then we'll go back over it again tomorrow afternoon. So after that, then the next paragraph it says, in general, as a preliminary to giving any profound instructions or engaging in meditation, all the holy beings of the different traditions in Tibet concord in doing what is called the four guiding instructions. And the four here are going for refuge and generating bodhicitta, Vajrasattva meditation, mandala offering, and guru yoga.
In which page?
One. So, those of you who have been in the Tibetan tradition a little bit probably find these quite familiar. And they come in the preliminaries. And so the Tibetan word for preliminary is nungdro. So often you hear people in the, particularly in the Kagyu and Nyingma school, they always saying, have you done your Nungdro yet? You know, your preliminaries. And so what they're referring to are these four here. And all of those there, even the first one, has a very much tantric flavour to it. Vajrasattva meditation, mandala offering and guru yoga are definitely tantra-type practices. And so then, because these come in the context of preliminaries, then people often feel like that's the very first thing they need to do. They come into Tibetan Buddhism, the first thing they need to do is these four things because they're the preliminaries. And each of them are intensive practices and they are often presented in that you have to do 100,000 of each of those. Like the refuge and bodhicitta, this prayer, it's a little bit like this four-line prayer, sometimes a little bit more elaborate prayer. You have to do that together with prostrations, 100,000 prostrations. And then the Vajrasattva meditation is you have to recite 100,000 Vajrasattva mantras. And then the mandala offering, you know, offering the mandala, you have to do 100,000 of those. And then the guru yoga also involves 100,000 repetitions of certain verses. And this is the preliminary. So people come into Tibetan Buddhism and think, okay, I need to do 100,000 of every one of those as a first thing. No. And unfortunately, that's often how it's actually presented. As we're going to see, because we're going to come back to this probably not even tomorrow, in a couple of days' time in the afternoon session, these are preliminaries for Tantra. These are preliminaries for tantric level of practice. They're not preliminaries to sutra level of practice. But each one of those four things has a specific purpose. And also at the sutra level, we have something sort of equivalent that serves the same purpose. So at the sutra level, there are sort of equivalent things to this that we can do as a good preparation. And we're going to look at those in a couple of days' time. So we need to understand that these are not preliminaries for practice in general. They are preliminaries for Tantra level of practice. They're preparing us to practice at the level of Tantra.
So why is it the case that it's often presented?
Because that's what they were developed in Tibet. In fact, these are a sort of a Tibetan invention. I think even in Tibetan Buddhism, they've only existed, as far as I'm aware, for the last 100 or 200 years. Before that, if you look in the early Tibetan, you'll never find these, you know.
But
so
they're for advanced students.
They are to prepare someone to practice Tantra.
Yeah.
So if you have done the basis, you have done Shamatha Vipassana, developed bodhicitta, and then you want to enter into Tantra, this is a good preparation for that.
Yeah. But then I don't understand why it's so often presented for beginners.
Because one of the reasons is that in the Kagyu and the Nyingma schools of Tibetan Buddhism, this differentiation between sutra and tantra level of practice is not really there so much. So, and it comes because Mahamudra and Dzogchen practice are taking the perspective of the result, meaning that they are often coming from the perspective of Tantra.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, to practice like that, you need to do this. But unfortunately then what happens is that often then Westerners who come into, particularly Kagyu Nyingma, one of the very first things they're asked to do is this. 100,000 of them. And of course, they've got no idea what they are, you know. And then they sort of try and do them, but of course, they can't do them very well because they don't have the background to understand how to do them properly. Maybe they get some benefit out of them, but the benefit that they could get because when they have a good basis is not there, you know. So, and in fact, a friend of mine, who was going into the Mahamudra sort of tradition, she was wanting to do some preliminary, some foundation things, and she had really a desire to do Shamatha retreat. But then she also saw these four preliminaries, and I think, I can't remember which one it was, maybe the first one, the prostrations or something. She couldn't do both because didn't have enough time, so she wondered, which one should I do? And so she went to a respected Tibetan master in Nepal, Cheki Nima, and she asked him, what should I do? And he said, yes, it is traditional in Tibet that this is the Nungdro, the preliminaries, but he said, for Westerners, I think we need to have different preliminaries. And that for Westerners, I recommend Shamatha and the Four Immeasurables as the preliminary. That's what he said. Okay, it's tea time, so let's have a tea break. And then after tea break, we'll come back into the Sutra Mahamudra, the Shamatha, which we started just before lunch. So we're going to start back on page 4 after the break. Okay, so let's have a tea break.